does it mean to be a Native American in the 21st century? We'll explore this question with a poet and an author who will share his life experiences ranging from his childhood on the Oneida Indian Reservation near Green Bay to his role as a modern-day elder. We'll also discuss identity, race, and the struggle of a culture to maintain its heritage. I'm Joy Cardine, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. We will talk with the author of How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century, and we'll welcome your questions for him and maybe even your own experiences. Are you a Native American? What is it like for you in the 21st century? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest, Lewis V. Clark III, or Two Shoes, was born and raised on the Oneida Reservation in northeastern Wisconsin. He is the author of Two Shoes and his latest work, How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century. He lives in Amro, and he joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you here.
Thank you
very much. You are retired from the Winnebago County Highway Department, and you currently work, though, for Mills Fleet Farm, and they gave you time off to come and do the interview. So, way to go, Mills.
Yes, thank you very much. It's very nice working, but they're very good to me.
Yeah, well, that's let's first off, do I call you Two Shoes? What does Two Shoes mean?
Well, Two Shoes is derived from basically when you leave the reservation, you're working in the white world, you're kind of afraid to make mistakes, and a gentleman at work, you started calling me Two Shoes, as in Goody Two Shoes, and the name kind of stuck, and so you get nicknames in the job force.
I see. So because if you make mistakes in the work world, the work world might be harder on you because you're a Native American.
Yeah, you're afraid. There's always a fear that something's going to happen, that you're going to lose your job. You know, you stake your career and your reputation on what you do, and so you never want to be wrong, I guess. Yeah. You don't have that freedom that other people, or it seems that other people have.
Well, let's get a little bit of your background here. Your mother was an American Indian. Your father was not.
Right. My dad was Polish. He was full-blooded Polish, and my mother was full-blooded Indian, and they were very wonderful and accomplished people, I guess you would say.
Yeah, and you wrote that you didn't know you were a Native American or an Indian until you went to grade school, because no one told you.
No, nobody tells you that you're an Indian. When we moved to the heart of the reservation, when I was about 5 years old, my mother told me that that's where all the Indians live, and that I was supposed to be nice to them. So I would sit on the sidewalk, on the curb, and I would ask people if they were Indians, because I was going to be nice to them if they were, and I got in a lot of trouble for that.
So you moved to the Oneida Reservation.
We lived on the outskirts of the Oneida Reservation in farming community, and then in 1960 we were able to buy a house right in the heart of Oneida, and that's where we moved.
Yeah. So when you went to school, how did you know then that you were an Indian?
Well, a lot of my cousins told me this is how they found out they were Indians, and this is how I found out why you were getting beat up by somebody and calling you a stupid Indian or something like that. You know, it seems like if you achieved more than you were supposed to, then you were put in your place when you were back on the playground.
Yeah. You know, and your title says Indian, and I'm saying Native American or American Indian because the Associated Press, you know, says to say Native American or American Indian either are acceptable. But you refer to yourself as an Indian.
Well, I'm an Indian. That's what I've been called all my life, and so you just accept it. There's nothing really derogatory about being called an Indian. We're very proud of being Indians. If you would really go back to it, we would be called Native Turtle Islanders, because we believe that our world is a giant turtle that was built upon turtles. So that's what we would be.
Yeah. Well, so I wanted to, your
I wanted you to read one of the poems that is in your book. You wrote about how you discovered you were Native American, and the poem is called First Grade Lessons. And why don't you read that to us?
Okay, it says, First Grade Lessons. I was flat on my back, getting hit in the face, when a young man informed me what was my race. I was bleeding and crying, but I couldn't agree. I didn't look like anything I saw on TV. I didn't have a pony. I only had a cat. My daddy didn't wear a loincloth, thank God for that. I never smoked a peace pipe or burned someone at the stake. I was just a little kid, oh, for heaven's sakes. We thought that we were people, my relatives and I, living, breathing human beings until the day we die. But religion called us savages, heathens, if you will. They paint our faces mascots like animals that you kill. That's the way it always is, the way it's always been. But what about this Jesus? What color was his skin?
So that's really powerful. Tell us the meaning of the poem.
Well, basically, the very first part is just, it's there, you know, that's how I learned that I was an Indian. And then I went to a Catholic school. I was the only Indian student at the Catholic school at the time. And it was, all the statues of baby Jesus had him as blonde hair and blue eyed, which kind of contradicted what I was led to believe that he was. And but I didn't mind the blue eyes because I have the blue eyes from my father, so that worked out for me. But in third grade, I was taught by the nuns, very loving people, so I you know, but that the Europeans came to America to, you know, save the savages and the heathens, to convert them. And I asked who the savages and the heathens were, and they said the Indians. So that was me and my family. So yeah. It was kind of difficult to equate that, because I was supposed to convert the people that I loved to Christianity, even though they were Christian, and I didn't know. But as a little kid, what do you know?
Yeah, but you know, I was also struck by the, hey, my dad didn't wear a loincloth. I have a cat, not a pony, because that's the stereotype that we have of American Indians, is that that's the life they lead, or that's the way they look, and you had nothing, that wasn't what was your case.
No, it was we were growing up in more or less the civilized country, you know. We had cars. My mom and dad were actually yuppies before our time, because they both worked. They both worked hard. They both worked many jobs. And then was the 1960s, so you had a lot of the, you know, the Rat Pack type influence into the family, where they would get all dressed up and go out on Friday nights. Unfortunately, you also had the stigma of the alcohol, and there was sadness and fighting, and because alcohol in the 60s didn't really go well together for a family environment.
No. Correct me if I'm wrong, was your father drank a lot?
Both my parents. My dad was a hard-living man. That's the way it was back then. It was the John Wayne stereotype. He worked hard. He drank hard. But he was a great individual. After he passed, and just the last year or so, my daughter, who served in the Afghanistan War, was able to get his war record, and we discovered that he had won the Bronze Star. And he had never told anybody. I mean, he didn't share certain war stories. World War II stories he would share, because he was 18, single, and he didn't have anything to lose, so he lived good. But when it came to the Korean War, everything was more or less a secret.
Yeah. So, explain, and I know that normally the authors don't write the titles to their books, but explain why the book is called How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century.
It was a snap judgment type of thing. What happened was, I was called down here to Madison to make a speech to some committee about the mascot issue in Berlin, Wisconsin. And after I made the speech, I was invited to a church in Berlin, because they were sending a bunch of students out west to work on an Indian reservation. So this was one of the greatest speeches I ever was a part of, because I talked for an hour, and then the kids, teenage kids, are really awesome. They asked me questions for an hour and a half, so I was on the podium for 2.5 hours. And a few weeks later, one of their mothers called and said that her daughter really loved my speech, and would I come up to this Wisconsin home and school meeting and give a speech? And she said, but what is the name of your speech? And so I thought really quick, and I thought, well, basically it's how to be an Indian in the 21st century. So that's how it actually all came about.
But is it difficult to be an Indian in the 21st century?
It's more honor. I mean, there's great honor in being an Indian in the 21st century because we have a great tradition. And if you go into history or anything, you'd notice that cultures that survive have great traditions. And the Native Americans, Indians, have great traditions. And I think we will survive, even though that it was one of the things that the society that ruled us for the last 200 years tried to stomp out was many of our traditions. But we're bringing them back, and Oneida's teaching our children our language again, and so we're really coming far.
We are talking with Lewis Clark, or Two Shoes, about his book, How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century. We welcome your questions for him. We welcome your own experiences. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. What do you think the challenges are when it comes to being a Native American in the 21st century? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Louis Clark. He was born and raised on the Oneida Indian Reservation in northeastern Wisconsin near Green Bay, and he is the author of How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century. We are talking with him about his experiences as a Native American today. He didn't know that he was Native American until he reached grade school, and then was bullied in part because of that. And we heard a little bit about that. And we will hear about his role as a modern-day elder. And we welcome your questions for him and your own experiences. Maybe you, too, are Native American. What is life like for you in the 21st century? Do you face any special challenges today? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So we talked, Louis, about the title of the book. How did the book come about?
That's a really interesting story. One of the young men that worked for me, Danny Braister, he was able to get an autograph from Paul Horning, great Packer player, for me, and I wrote Horning a thank you letter, and he ended up calling us, my wife and I, and we talked, and he said I should write a book about him. So I did, and then someone else came up and said I should turn my speech into a book, and that's how to be an Indian came into being. But I was giving a talk at the Amaro Kiwanis Club, and they said I should send both books down to the Wisconsin Historical Society because they thought they both had meaning. So Wisconsin Historical Society called me down here, and we came down, and the lady on the GPS has a really good sense of humor. She sent me right at the end of State Street. She told me to turn right, and I went right down the sidewalk over to the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Well, that's a way to get there.
And we get there, and we were taken upstairs, and the editors were real nice to us, and they showed us that they had just done two Packer books and that they weren't interested in doing Packer books. And then the editor sat down and she said, and we don't even accept submissions like How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century. And I was totally shocked. I was standing there like that Make America Beautiful Indian from with one tear coming down my face. And she said, but we read it. And it's very interesting, and if you let us publish it, we'd be interested in publishing it. And, well, of course I'm going to let them publish it. It was very nice.
Yeah, and it is poetry and essays for the most part, and you really do, you know, cover some heavy territory here with, you know, getting beat up in grade school and alcoholism and the death of loved ones. Was it hard to address these topics in your writing?
Well, actually, I started writing poetry in the sixth grade, and it was during the era of the, you know, the Monkees, the 1960s, Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, and I fell in love with their type of music, and I thought that their music was poetry, and they always described Bobby Dylan and Smokey Robinson as these great poets, and so I wanted to write that type of poetry, but it was also a cleansing for me. If I hurt, you can't fight your whole life. You get old and your muscles get weak, but you can cleanse and face racism, those things, through words. And that's what I did. I always wrote, and my wife and my family accepted that I would always write. And yes, I had dreams of being a great poet and a great writer, but that I was told over and over that poetry doesn't rhyme anymore. If you want to rhyme, go to Nashville. And how is an Indian going to make it in cowboy land? So I just, at one time, I just decided that I was going to write what I wanted, write what I felt. And I heard the drums. When I was young, I went to a powwow, and it was a real powwow. It was tents and teepees and campers, and they had three drums there, and the drums were beating all day. And it's not the white man drums that you hear on TV that go boom, 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 boom. These were a cadence that just went over and over and over. And I was reinforced in my decision to write in a cadence like that by Langston Hughes, a great black poet, because he wrote in a blues cadence. So I just decided to write what I wanted to write, and I didn't care if it got published. I didn't care if anybody read it. I just wrote it for me. I wrote it for my family. It's for a legacy for my family to read as they got older. And lo and behold, miracles of miracles, two books were published.
Yeah. And, you know, you talked about the mascot issue and how you, did you testify at a legislative hearing about the mascot issue?
It was something like that. Yeah. I'm not for sure why.
Oh, like a school board meeting because it was a Native American mascot?
It was a Native American mascot, but it was down here in Madison, and it was before a judge and everything, and before Scott Walker came into the governorship, and so that it, and then they asked me to come down, and I did. So, and I just told them about what I had seen, kids doing the tomahawk chop, dressing like Indians, and my kids had to play sports in these arenas where they were doing those type of things, and I had hoped as growing up that my kids would never have to face those type of situations. And even though they did, I think it was easier the way we brought the kids up.
Yeah. And of course, throughout that debate, we heard those who said these mascots are honoring Native Americans, and you did not believe this was honoring Native Americans.
Well, I guess the biggest one is the Redskins. In 1653, the New England Trading Company put a bounty out on the American Indians, and it was like 200 pounds for a male, 100 pounds for a female, 50 pounds for a child. And the way that you had to prove that you had eliminated an Indian or killed an Indian was to provide a piece of scalp with red skin on it. And so I don't understand how anybody can think that calling us Redskins would be honoring us.
Yeah. Tom from Hazel Green emailed wondering what you think about Native American mascots. Do you think we're on the right track and that they're I mean, the Washington Redskins are still there, but at least in the state of Wisconsin, many of them have been replaced.
Many of them have been replaced, but there's still a long way to go. And I don't think that you can equate an Indian with like a bear or a ram or a deer or something that you hang on the wall. I would hate to see my head hanging on a wall.
Yeah, you said that talking with other Native Americans, though, even was it young people that they didn't really care, or they didn't think that there's anything wrong with it until you explained it to them?
Yes, it was basically my elders that I was talking with, and they said, "Well, what's the big difference? They're honoring us." And then when I explained how it hurt and how the Redskins was not a good term for us, then I won them over, and they understood. And it's you know, it takes a long time to learn things. Maybe this is why it took until I was in my 60s to get books published. But you know,
and now you said you were explaining to your elders, you are considered an elder.
Well, basically it's nice that when you become an elder, because you get to sit in the front row, you get into the powwows for free, but
you get the senior discount,
right? And but I'm not living on the reservation, so I'm not really a part of the whole government or anything. But in our family, I am considered an elder, and people come to me for advice a little bit, because I have a little bit more understanding of life as it goes, and I've seen and done a lot.
We are talking with Louis Clark. He is the author of How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century. He grew up on the Oneida Reservation near Green Bay, and he is a poet and an author, and we are welcoming your questions for him. We're also welcoming any experiences you might like to share. Maybe you have some thoughts on what it's like to be an Indian in the 21st century. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Kathleen from Viroqua sent an email and says, "I was born in Oneida County, New York. When I moved to Wisconsin 7 years ago, I was surprised and puzzled to learn that there is an Oneida County in Wisconsin. All five Great Lakes are between those two places. How big could this tribe be? Of course, the Oneida Indians left New York at some point, probably not voluntarily." Well, not only is there Oneida County, there's the Oneida Indian Reservation, which is different than Oneida County. And you write about this in the book. The Oneidas relocated?
What we did in 1834, we actually bought, I think it was almost a million acres from the Menominee Indians. And from New York State, we had a walk from New York State all the way to Wisconsin. And right now they're doing up in Oneida, I think it's Norby Hill is gathering letters from and artifacts from that walk, and they're going to be in the exhibit, I believe. So it was about 1834 that 734 of us, I believe, came to this area. And my wife and I, being Native American elders and looking forward, we wanted our children to have education. And one of the nice things is that when Lawrence University was inaugurated in about 1848, five of the first 38 students were Oneida tribal members. And then we were lucky to have four of our sons go to Lawrence University, and our two daughters graduated from UW schools. The big thing there is that it's people believe that Indians get free education. My children didn't. I'm half Indian. They're a quarter Indian. But because of paperwork, basically, they're not considered full members of our tribe. And so they did get a little help from the federal government, but they pretty much had to fund their own education. But we're so proud that all six of our children graduate from college.
Oh, that's wonderful. So in grade school, you attended school on the reservation. In high school, you attended school off the reservation. What was that experience like?
The sad thing was that, and I don't know how many other Indian students were taken aside, but I was taken aside by a teacher and told that I don't have to study. All I had to do was cooperate and graduate, keep my mouth shut, and I would graduate. And keeping my mouth shut was really difficult because I'm not that type of person. And every night on the bus, a student would beat me up until I finally stood up for myself. And one of the stories I like to tell is that on the bus, I got in a fight, and the bus driver tackled me and held me down. And 5 years later, I married her niece.
Oh, seriously. Oh, my goodness. Well, that's something. But I'm still, you got beat up all the time because of your race? Because you're an Indian? Or what were these bullies doing?
I don't know. You just get, it's just maybe your attitude or something. But yeah. You just get beat up if you let it happen. And
Is that why the teacher said keep your mouth shut?
Oh, I don't know why the teacher took me aside and said, you just keep your mouth shut. So I spent a lot of time in the library, which was a good thing. I got to read a lot of good books and that type of thing. And The Count of Monte Cristo was big in my life. I read that book. And Cervantes was big. So I got to read a lot of stuff that maybe other kids who were in class didn't get to read. And but I didn't do very good in high school. But then when we were 23 years old, my wife and I decided that we wanted more for our family. And we moved from the reservation down to Oshkosh, and I started to go to college. And because we were raising a family and we had six kids, we had to do the parent thing, and which was difficult. And my wife and I coached baseball, Little League baseball, for 19 years. And the kids started calling my wife Coach Honey because I always called her Honey. but it took me 25 years of night school to finally graduate, but I'm very glad I did. And so it was a legacy for the kids. And we truly believe in education. We're hoping that this book opens a few eyes to see that we're not really different, that though we're different, we have to enjoy each other's differences, but we're pretty much all the same.
Yeah. And do you still face or see discrimination against you because of your Indian heritage today?
Not so much anymore since, because who can, I have a white beard and I don't really look Indian. I sound Indian, I think, because other people said I sound Indian. But people who know, yes and no, you don't know if, you never really know when you're facing discrimination or racism. You just don't know unless it's blatant, like where they said you're one dead Indian. that's pretty easy to understand.
Do you still see, though, any discrimination against Native Americans today, even if it's not against you personally?
Oh, I'm sure. If you look, I don't think that there would be Indian mascots out there if that wasn't a form of discrimination. I realize that people think they are honoring the Indians. But with the discrimination that I have seen and I've had and I have encountered, I'm always surprised when people say that they wish that they were Indians, because why would you want to go through that stuff if you wouldn't have to?
Yeah. You know what I hear too, and I don't recall it really being addressed in your writing, was the belief or the stereotype that all Native Americans in Wisconsin are living high off the hog because of gambling proceeds.
Well, it was very nice to be able to. What I believe really happened is around 1968. The Oneidas discovered that they could sell tobacco without taxes. And in our history of the Iroquois Confederacy, the Haudenosaunee, the tobacco story is that at one time that the Indians were, living high on the hog, as you say, and not respecting everything. And so then all of a sudden, game got scarce and that stuff, and so they went to a holy man. And the holy man said, well, what you have to do is kill me, cut up my body and spread it in this valley and come back a year later. So when they came back a year later, the valley was full of tobacco, and they used the tobacco to communicate, send up their prayers to heaven. So in 1968, when our reservation was almost nil, I don't think we had hardly any acreage left. It was all privately owned. We discovered that we could sell tobacco without taxes, and from there came bingo, which was quite easy because I was a Catholic Indian, so I had bingo on both sides of the family. And then in the 80s, we had the casino, and there's a lot of debate whether these are good or bad, but we have our own school system, we have our nursing home, we have so many things for the Indians to learn and to help with education, and I think it's a good thing. But no, we're not living high on the hog. I think there's a belief that we get these monthly checks, and if we do, I'm like 61 years short.
Yeah, you need your check, huh?
Check. Yeah.
Let's go to Margo in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Margo.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am just over the moon. I have asked public radio and public television many times to get more information and talk to more Native Americans. I want to learn everything I can. As a child, my family would go up to Hayward on the Chippewa flowage, and my first two friends, I'll never forget it, were Tom, who repaired the boats at the resort we stayed at. He was a Native American, and I was probably four. That's how long it's stuck with me. And my little friend was the housekeeper's daughter, and I remember her name was Little Sister. And I've just been such a part of it in the powwows. And then later in life, I read the book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which broke my heart to realize how terribly Native Americans have been treated. And I think you should be so proud. And I'm glad the Oneida are getting their language back and their culture back. What was done to the Native American people is just unbelievably horrid. And I always wanted to be a Native American. might have a little Cherokee blood in me. I'm not sure. We haven't traced back that far. But I just am so impressed, and I can't wait to get my hands on your book.
Yeah. Thank you, Marco.
Thank you. Thank you. If nothing else, go to the library and request the book. I think it's selling quite well. I don't know. I never asked. But it did win some award, Midwest Booksellers Choice Award, and it's making an impact. I think if people read it, it's not just a poetry book. I think you could take the poetry out and it'd be a good book. And people read it, and I'm getting a lot of good feedback on it. And it's life, and music is life, and poetry is life, and it's there for the reading, and I hope you enjoy it.
Margo said, she said when she was growing up, she wanted to be a Native American, and you kind of smiled.
Well, that's just because that so many people say that they want to be a Native American, and when you're sitting in class and you're not getting good grades, even though you think you should be, or if you're applying for jobs and you're scoring the highest on the test and you're not getting the jobs, and you go out and somebody makes an inappropriate remark to your wife and like, how could you marry an Indian? You wonder, why would anybody want to be an Indian? I'm very glad for what I am, and I'm very glad for the things I've learned, and very glad for the history and the honor of being an Indian. But I'm just as proud of being from my Polish roots. My dad was just an awesome individual. My mom was an awesome individual. They succumbed to humanity, of course, and we all do. But
Did you think did you agree with Margo in her assessment that the I guess the American Indian in general was treated horrifically by the white majority.
If you read the history, yes, they were. But you can't live in the past and have hate. We live in the greatest country in the world. I mean, everything's wonderful, no matter what's going on. Bottom line, my dad did teach me that when he was all over the world, and he came back and he just said that America is the greatest country that has ever been, and just be happy you live in it and be willing to stand up for it. It's like a family, you know. If anybody can in the family can put you down, but don't let the outsiders put you down, I guess.
We are talking with Louis Clark. He is the author of How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century. If you have a question for him, or maybe your own experience that you'd like to share, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. What does it mean to be a Native American in the 21st century? We are exploring that question with our guest, who is a poet and who is an author of How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century. We are talking about his experiences, ranging from growing up on the Oneida Reservation near Green Bay and getting beat up at school, talking about mascots, talking about facing racism, and welcoming your questions, welcoming your experiences. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Mentioned, Louis Clark is the author of How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century, and this book is it's essays and poems and much more, but we asked you to read some of your poetry, Louis. Let's dig a little bit into the poem that you call Two Shoes. In the prose previewing it, you write that no matter how we face it, we always run into racism, and that is how you earned the name Two Shoes. We talked a little bit about that earlier, but why don't you share with us the first two stanzas of the poem?
Okay, it's called Two Shoes. They call me Two Shoes, as in Goody, trained to toe the line. Two Shoes, as in Goody, afraid to speak my mind. A fist came flying from the night to change my point of view. A bottle poured inside my home poisoned my parents, too. I watched my sisters state their cause and the havoc that ensued. Even parties I always feared for the trouble that they brewed. That started out, the beginning started out is when I was in the workforce, and sometimes I would have liked to said something, stood up for myself, but sometimes you're afraid to because you don't want to lose what you have. The second stanza talked about the alcoholism that invaded our house. Basically, my mother was the head hostess at the Oneida Golf and Riding Club, which was really nice. A lot of perks to that. But one of the ladies, as a game, showed my mom that she hid a little bottle of brandy in her purse and would take a nip every once in a while. And once my mother got involved with that, it was downhill pretty quick. She succumbed. My mother was a great woman. She won an award during World War II, and Eleanor Roosevelt came and presented the prize. She was a strong woman. It's just that once alcoholism invades your life, it's difficult to get out of.
A caller from Eau Claire, the Chippewa Falls area, says, I was married to a Native American until he passed away after 38 years together. When we were dating in the 1960s, and even to this day with my kids, it's horrible how American Indians are bullied, picked on, beat up in high school. They even make stereotypical comments about my grandchildren working in casinos, always being drunk. Parents need to teach their children that they are good people.
Oh, well, that's very nice. Thank you. Yeah, that's I've always thought that we were good people.
Yeah, you were good people. But doesn't that? I don't know. That just makes me mad that in 2017.
I don't think it should make you mad. It should make you want to do something about it because you should be understanding. We're all the same. We're all different, and yet we're all the same. And I went to work last year. I retired, but I still need work for insurance, as we do. And I went to work at a factory, Alliance of Ripon, and so many different people, so many different cultures, and everybody is a good worker. I mean, they, outside their life, in the outside world, they might be different, but they're all good workers, and they're all good people, and it's a melting pot. America's a melting pot, and we're very lucky to be here.
We'll go to John in Green Bay now. Hi, John.
Good morning. I'm a resident of Green Bay and happen to live within the boundary of the Oneida Reservation. See a lot of the license plates, and I'm wondering if you could talk about the different clans.
Well, the Oneidas have three clans, the turtle, the bear, and the wolf. And the turtle, the wolf clan, I guess, is kind of like, they go out and search things and take care of things, and the bear clan is the medicine, takes care of the medicine, and I'm not sure what the turtle clan is.
Steady wins the race, no, I don't.
Right. Because I wasn't raised with Indian knowledge.
You weren't a member of a clan while you lived on the reservation.
Everyone, I think, is a member of a clan.
Which clan were you a member of?
We're Bear Clan, mm-hmm. And I think we're storytellers and artists because everybody in my family are storytellers and artists, and they're very good artists. But
you weren't really raised with deep knowledge of what each clan was and.
No, anything that I learned about being an Indian, about, you know, that type of thing was from books. And I've studied and learned about the Iroquois Confederacy and those types of things. So I really wasn't able to participate like I would have. I grew up with the kids. We ran the woods. I know the Oneida Woods as well as anyone at the time. But I just don't know about our heritage, our traditions. Nobody wanted to be an Indian in the early 60s. We all had crew cuts and work shoes, and it was only the white kids who were allowed to have long hair until 1968 and the Great Revolution.
Really? So when the hippies started, you as an Indian were, you had a crew cut to, why was that?
I don't know, because that's the way the people on TV looked, I think. Oh. I mean, that's what America looked like. Leave It to Beaver, Wally, they all had short hair. They wanted us to assimilate. And it wasn't until, I basically, 1967, 1968, my sister found out that she could go to college and get a little bit of money, and we started looking into more things, and then I just remember we had a drive-in on the reservation, and this one day we went in driving, and there was this coolest-looking gentleman there. He had long hair all the way down to his belt. He had a white T-shirt on with a marble pack rolled up on the sides, and he had boots, and he was playing the pinball machine, and I think Pinball Wizard was playing. I don't know if it was the time, but, I mean, that's what all the kids, or at least I thought, an Indian should look like, and that gave us something to look forward to, and I started growing my hair long, and we all started growing our hair long then.
Yeah, so is that one of the challenges or do you struggle with today that an Indian in the 21st century is not like an Indian in the 18th century?
Oh, no, I mean, we couldn't be. Mm-hmm. Nobody is. I think the greatest invention in life has been indoor plumbing. And my poor wife, I don't know, she married into this culture. And I don't like camping. I don't like going places. When I was a little kid, my parents would bring me home. They said I'd run from room to room kissing the walls just to be home. And so I'm not much for being out and doing the Indian things. I do hunt. I like to hunt. And I think it's wonderful that the animals give their lives up for us to sustain us. Last year, I finally got a deer. In my dream hunt, I had walked out to the car to have a sandwich, and the deer came and sacrificed itself right by the car.
Oh, wow. So, a car. Yeah, I saw a lot of them up north when I was driving.
And
this
weekend. So I'm... No, we don't. Yeah. It's a different than the 1800s. I wouldn't have wanted to live in the 1800s.
Read, please, as we are running short on time, the poem "Torn" as we end our conversation today. Once you read that, you can explain a little bit more.
Okay. This is a poem that most people ask me to read. I am torn between the wilderness of my youth and the white world we call civilization, between the freedom of the fields and the fight for human dignity, between the false comfort of an apathetic attitude and the calamities inherent in having empathy for my brothers and sisters of all nations. I am torn between the false security promoted by technologies that leave us fat and swollen upon the couches of our homes and the savage need to rebel against an authority that fails to abide by the very laws they are sworn to uphold, between the urge to close my eyes to hide away from the injustices of the world and the desire to plant the seeds of freedom of justice to watch them bloom. Please, Lord, grant me the wisdom to overcome the conflicts of my humanity and the courage to make my life meaningful.
And what do you hope people take away from your experiences?
I just hope that they see that we're together and we're not that much different, and we have to learn to come together, because if we all come together and quit being afraid of each other, I think we could have just the most fantastic world. One quote that I always end my speeches with is right out of the book, and it says, "People will give you what you expect of them eventually, so always expect the best." And I think that's basically what the whole book is summed up in, that we want to expect the best of everybody and that we'll all try to do what's right.
We'll leave it there.
Okay.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Lewis V. Clark III is the author of How to Be an Indian in the 21st Century. And we thank him for his time, and we thank you for your calls and your participation. I want to encourage you to stay tuned and join Kathleen Dunn this afternoon between 1 and 3. It's going to be one of her last days on the air at Wisconsin Public Radio as she is retiring. This coming Thursday will be her last day on the air. She will be talking with legends with the Milwaukee Brewers. Bob Uecker and Bud Selig will be with her from 1 until 1:30. She'll talk with President Obama's senior advisor, David Axelrod, at 1:30. Then she will be talking about the power of therapy animals in her 2 o'clock hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.